Beautiful choir. Thank you. Dona nobis pacem. May the divine grant us peace. Certainly a profound and needed prayer in such a time as this. So I've started planning to lead a group pilgrimage to Israel and Palestine in January of 2020 with the intention of traveling that summer. I could not foresee that 3 months later, the COVID pandemic would end up delaying our trip by 3 years. I'm grateful to the intrepid group of 20 participants from UUCF who made our 10-day trip possible this past June. And this photo, it's kind of hard to tell, but we're on top of the Mount of Olives. And if you have really good vision, you can see in the kind of center in the distance, the little tiny golden-topped Dome of the Rock. In preparation for the trip and in the 6 months since our return, I have read thousands of pages about Israel and Palestine and listened to hundreds of hours of audio. If you are interested in my recommended resources for learning more, there's a list of recommended books and podcasts and films available here. You can find that at frederickuu.org/pilgrimage. So just you have to type that in, frederickuu.org/pilgrimage. If you forget, email me. But even that curated 3-page list can be overwhelming. So if I had to limit myself to just one source, how many of you podcast? How many of you listen to podcasts? Okay. If not, Google, how do I podcast? And it will tell you. I would recommend the Ezra Klein Show. That podcast is free on all the major platforms, and transcripts are available on the New York Times website if you prefer to read instead of listen. He's done 10 podcast episodes. He's done other things, but if you just listen to the 10 podcast episodes he's done since October 7th on Israel and Palestine, he's really consistently covered some of the major issues at the heart of this conflict, bringing in really experts and Israelis and Palestinians. If I had to say one thing, that's a good place to start. For this morning, I could talk for many, many hours about each day of our 10-day trip. I'm going to do my best to distill it down to sharing just a few major highlights with you. We booked our trip through a company that specializes in dual narratives. So we had both an Israeli and a Palestinian tour guide almost the whole time in dialogue with one another about all that we were seeing. Upon our return home, most of us were understandably freshly invested in the future of both Israelis and Palestinians. But most of the rest of the world, you know, back in the summer and into the early fall, remained too complacent about Israel's more than 50-year occupation of the West Bank and 16-year blockade of the Gaza Strip. Yes, I know it's complicated. We're getting to that. But my point at the moment is that after October 7th, the world's attention is newly focused on this highly contested land, and it's become clear that the previous status quo is unsustainable for everyone. To begin to orient ourselves, here's a map of Israel in purple overlaid on a map of New Jersey in that kind of salmon color. They are almost precisely the same size. I think it's important to keep in mind just how small an area of land we're talking about. It's like, you know, kind of if you just took New Jersey in your mind and just kind of isolated that, that's what we're fighting about. There's not a lot of land to go around, and that's going to inform what I'm building to. And speaking of land, as much as I love reading books and watching films, there's nothing compared to the immersive experience of being in a place in person. So after an 11-hour red-eye flight and a relatively short taxi ride, we checked into our hotel in Jerusalem, and there was a sign in the lobby encouraging guests to be sure to check out the view from the roof. Okay, you know, we can do that. So after eating the first of many incredible meals, I could talk for at least an hour about the food, but we're not going to do that. We boarded the elevator to check out the view, and they weren't kidding. It wasn't really clear from street level, but just a few stories up, this wasn't a super tall hotel, and suddenly you could see just how close we already were to the Dome of the Rock, one of the most iconic landmarks in the world, and I couldn't help thinking, we are in the thick of it now, because this site in particular is so fiercely contested. For Muslims, this is inside the Dome of the Rock. The rock around which this Dome of the Rock is built is traditionally believed to be the location from which Muhammad took what is called the night journey, this mystical experience of feeling lifted up to heaven. It would be difficult to overemphasize how important this site is for many Muslims. It's it's technically the third holiest site in Islam. If you're curious, the single most holiest site in Islam is the Kaaba, the cube, that if you remember, famous for people circumambulating around it during the Hajj, the pilgrimage. And the silver medalist is the Prophet's Mosque in Medina that you're seeing there on the right. The golden topped Dome of the Rock is only one part of what's called the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. So the Dome of the Rock's the golden top building, the larger plaza is the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. But here's the thing, this is all built on top of the site of the ancient Jewish temple that was destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. That means the third holiest site in Islam is built on top of the first holiest site in Judaism. Some of you will recall that Hamas named the October 7th terrorist attacks Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, which adds yet one more layer onto this combustibly controversial piece of land. Some of you may have seen there were plans to do this Maccabean march of Jews onto the Temple Mount because Jews are forbidden currently from praying on the Temple Mount. Thankfully, they shut that down because that would have made a currently combustible situation even more combustible. So we were allowed to visit the Dome of the Rock. I took this photo. We were allowed to get as close as we would like to the outside. Only Muslims are allowed inside. In person, you get a much better appreciation of this expansive plaza that makes up the Al-Aqsa compound as a whole. The relatively tiny humans, if you can see them, gives you a sense of scale of how big a place we're talking about. In this photo, you can also see how this large plaza allows you to fully walk around the Dome of the Rock. And if we zoom out in a different direction, you can see how close the Dome of the Rock on the left is to the Western Wall on the right, which is the only remaining part of the ancient Jewish temple that was destroyed by the Romans. Here's a close-up of that Western Wall, also known as the Kotel. It's well known for people writing prayers, right, and sticking them in the cracks. But to clear up one common confusion, the Western Wall is not an actual wall of the temple. You can see this in this graphic. Note the Western Wall down on the left and the temple up and to the right. The Western Wall is a section of that retaining wall that surrounded the court of the Gentiles that was around the temple, that large plaza. So if you compare that to today, and you kind of have to shift it in your mind, so it's perpendicular, right? You kind of have to go like this. I tried flipping the photo, but it doesn't help. You can see how Western Wall, Temple, Western Wall, Dome of the Rock, so how the ancient temple is directly underneath where the Dome of the Rock is today. Now, as we continue, I'm going to be weaving together both Israeli and Palestinian perspectives. For now, I would be remiss if I failed to mention that for many Jews, the Western Wall is one of the most iconic symbols of this ancient feeling of connection to this land, which for Jews stretches back for millennia. For some of you, various caveats are springing to mind, but what about this? What about this? What about this? And as we continue, I'll invite you to consider the challenge that our Israeli and Palestinian tour guides both reminded us of at various points. They said, try to listen and to understand and to appreciate how both sides understand their respective sides of the story, because weaving both those narratives together may be the only hope of finding a way forward together. And I wanted to start here at the Temple Mount, not only because it's where we started this summer, but also because it's a microcosm of this larger conflict. Two groups with competing claims to this very small piece of land. I'll have to limit myself to showing you just one more Israeli site before shifting to Palestine. This is Yad Vashem, the Israeli Holocaust memorial. Do you see that kind of long, skinny, triangular-shaped, almost like tent-like building in the center? That's the central part of the museum, but all of that is actually part of the museum as a whole. How many of you have been to the U.S. Holocaust Museum in D.C.? Okay, a lot of you. If you haven't been, it's very powerful. I highly recommend visiting. Yad Vashem, obviously, is also incredibly powerful. But interestingly, it has strikingly different architecture and pedagogical frameworks and experiences. How many of you have been to Yad Vashem? Okay, and how many have been to Yad Vashem since 2005? Because it's completely different. It's completely different since 2005. It's very different than I was last there in 1999 before this summer and saw a completely different Yad Vashem. There's a lot to say. I'm going to share with just the single most memorable experience to me came at the end of this very harrowing journey through remembering the Holocaust. And you emerge onto this elevated deck with a spectacular view of precisely one thing: the land of Israel. The full panorama is much more than I could capture in a photograph, but this image gives you the basic point. For many Jews, one tragic lesson of the Holocaust, which ended less than 100 years ago, is that the nations of the world cannot be counted on to stop anti-Semitism at its worst. So after the slaughter of one-third of world Jewry, and it's important to keep in mind, like today, there are 15 million Jews in the world. 15 million, that's it, all total, in the entire globe. That after that slaughter of one-third of world Jewry, returning to the land of Israel was an attempt to create a country in which Jews could defend themselves. Now, we all know there's more to the story. And that Zionist slogan of a land without a people for a people without a land, that tragically failed to account for the Palestinians' own deep ties to that same land. So from a dual perspective narrative of having both an Israeli and a Palestinian tour guide, I need to add one more important point, because 1 mile from the Israel Holocaust Museum is the site of the Deir Yassin massacre of 1948. During the first Arab-Israeli war, the Jewish military destroyed this Palestinian Arab village, killing more than 100 of its residents, and the graves of those Palestinians who died at Deir Yassin remain unknown and unmarked to this day. So to me, it's this deep contrast with the Holocaust memorial that's dedicated to the memory of Jews who were killed, and rightly so, but there's not this sort of similar remembrance of those who died at Deir Yassin. This is only one story among so many of what the Palestinians call the Nakba, literally the catastrophe, which led to the violent expulsion and flight of approximately 700,000 Palestinians from their homes in the same year, 1948, that the modern state of Israel celebrated its independence. So as I hold in my heart both Yad Vashem, the Israeli Holocaust Memorial, and Deir Yassin, as well as the Holocaust, as well as the Nakba, this one of many sites of Palestinian dispossession, I want to be clear that by no means am I calling for less Holocaust education. Indeed, in the face of Holocaust denial in Palestine and other parts of the world, we need more Holocaust education in many places with the rise of anti-Semitism. But in Israel and around the world, we also need much more education about the historic and ongoing Nakba of Palestinians. To that end, if I had to select the single most iconic image that I saw during the half of the trip that we spent in Palestine, it was this giant key. It's over an ark in the Ada Palestinian refugee camp, which is located only a mile north of the historic center of Bethlehem in the West Bank. This key represents the physical keys that Palestinians took with them when they were forced to flee in the 1948 Nakba, the keys to their front doors that they assumed they were coming back. Like, you would take your keys, if something terrible happened. Many Palestinians still have those keys to their front doors, even though a tragic number of those homes have now been destroyed. Metaphorically, this giant key also symbolizes the Palestinian right of return, the political position that Palestinian refugees and their descendants have a legal and human right to the property that they were forced to leave behind during the 1948 Nakba, which again led to the displacement of a majority of Palestinian Arabs. Note as well the trash piled up on the left. There's just too much trash piled up in the Ada refugee camp and in many other parts of the West Bank. It is not because people don't care. It is due both to the ongoing Israeli occupation as well as, to be frank, to the corrupt and dysfunctional Palestinian Authority. The lack of regular trash pickup is only one among many daily indignities that Palestinians face. And as a result, the trash is often burned. It was a truly noxious odor while we were there, and it's this ongoing health hazard for residents. In these photos, you also see the giant 26-foot high separation wall. You can get a kind of a sense of scale from the cars that was built by the Israeli military that continues in other areas of the West Bank. In total, the separation wall is 439 miles long. This refugee camp is terrible enough in isolation, but it is an even more devastating contrast when you drive 1 mile away and see the golden embossed interior of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, this traditional site associated with the birth of Jesus. I mean, it's just, you know, going from, it's just a lot. For this Christmas season, to reflect on the devastation in Gaza, the nearby Lutheran church in Bethlehem took their traditional manger scene. So if any of you have like little wooden manger scenes, they took that in their church and they set it amongst rubble. You can kind of see the various pieces. As a reminder that Jesus was born in what is today occupied Palestine. Now, he was actually born in Nazareth, but that's a story for another day. That Bethlehem thing is just a tie into David. It's not true, but it's a nice story. But this image is powerful nonetheless. And personally, one of my historians, you do need to know that if you travel with me to Israel and Palestine, I am going to debunk your mythology. I'm just not going to let it go. But anyway. Personally, one of my takeaways from visiting Palestine, yeah, I know, you're welcome. The tragic truth is there was not peace this summer. There was not peace on October 6th, the day before the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack. There's not been peace for decades. So yes, it's important to learn and acknowledge all of the historical context. You know, I can talk for hours about all of that. You can look into the resources that I shared for more. Those Ezra Klein podcasts will give you a good quick overview, including the horrific suicide bombings in Israel during the Second Intifada, the many missiles that have been launched into Israel, which are all major factors behind why that separation wall was built. But we also need to be aware that on October 5th, that's 2 days before the heinous October 7th attacks. On October 5th, the United Nations had reported that 2003 at that point was already the deadliest year for Palestinians since it began recording Palestinian deaths in 2006. The so-called Netanyahu Doctrine, named after Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been the Israeli prime minister since 2009, with one very brief exception. Hopefully he will no longer be prime minister very soon. This doctrine held that it was possible to maintain this indefinite military occupation of the West Bank and blockade of Gaza while allowing Israeli settlers to incrementally take over more and more land in the West Bank. Now, don't get me wrong, Hamas's brutal attack on civilians on October 7th, deadliest single day for Jews since the Holocaust, it's one of the worst imaginable ways of getting the world's attention on Palestine. And the Israeli military's collective punishment, killing more than 17,000 Gazans so far, including more than 17,000 children, not even getting into injuries and psychological trauma, it's one of the worst imaginable ways for Israel to respond. You know, targeted counterterrorism is only one among possible alternatives that would have had far fewer civilian casualties. It would be difficult to come up with a more classic example of what's called a vicious cycle, a negative feedback loop. You know, a Jewish fundamentalist kills the Jewish prime minister, not a Palestinian, a Jewish fundamentalist killed the Jewish prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin, in 95, undermining the Israeli peace process. Palestinian suicide bombers in the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, undermining any hope on the Jewish left that any peace process could be successful. Hamas spending billions of dollars building underground tunnels instead of investing in their people and infrastructure and education. Hamas cynically using its civilian population as human shields. The daily humiliations and often violent assaults that characterize Palestinian life in the West Bank under Israeli occupation. The desperate humanitarian crisis coming out of the blockade of the Gaza Strip. I could just keep going on, but it is this just terrible descending spiral for all concerned. The opposite of a vicious cycle is a virtuous cycle, this positive feedback loop where you begin to build trust and go from strength to strength. To quote Dr. Sarah Kendzior, one of the most incisive contemporary political commentators on how do we resist systems of oppression, she said, "Truth and compassion are the only way out. Truth and compassion are the only way out. You can't bomb your way to peace. It's like trying to have sex for virginity. Like, it's like, you know, like, truth and compassion are the only way out." For too long, both Israelis and Palestinians have been fed too much information and half-truths, and it's led to this hardening of hearts all around. I'm acutely aware that today, December 10th, is the literal 75th anniversary of the adoption of the UN Declaration of Human Rights on December 10th, 1948. And the current trajectory continues to entrench a horrifying cycle of violence, of war crimes, of crimes against humanity, and even beginning to reverse course to plant seeds of truth and compassion feels increasingly difficult. In recent weeks, I've been revisiting the writings of Edward Said, the Palestinian professor of literature at Columbia University, who is one of the founders of postcolonial studies. Said died more than two decades ago in 2003. His writings about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict span decades, but reading his essays from many years ago, they feel like they could be written yesterday, because this situation just hasn't changed. It's just been plowing on, and you know, the same terrible patterns have continued to repeat. Way back in 1999, Said observed trenchantly that the conflict appears intractable because it is a contest over the same land by two peoples who always believed they had a valid title to it and who hoped the other side in time would give up or go away. Fast forwarding more than two decades to today, it has long been clear that neither side is going anywhere. Palestinians have repeatedly shown a fierce dedication to the land, and Israel is a major military force. Indeed, Israel is a nuclear power. That's France's fault, not the U.S.'s, I mean, or whatever. It's, but it seems unlikely that Israel is going anywhere either. But after October 7th, it is increasingly difficult for the Israeli far right to plausibly claim that this never-ending occupation and blockade is going to provide security for Israel. So how do we move closer to a way forward that is characterized by what our UU's sixth principle calls peace, liberty, and justice for all? Peace, liberty, and justice for all. I want to invite us to spend just a few moments reflecting on where we go from here in light of our UU values, with love at the center. To begin to do so, I invite you to hear a profound spoken word poem written recently by the therapist, the somatics teacher, and political organizer, Prentice Hemphill. Love has told me lately. I think that's an important, you know, some of you remember in the first sermon I preached about a month ago on Israel and Palestine, I said, you know, pay attention to love and doubt, right? We looked at another poem. Love has told me lately that I have to let my heart break. That's that truth and compassion are the only way out. I have to let my heart break without seeking its repair too soon, and that I have to speak before the words have formed fully in my mouth. I have to risk being misunderstood to show you who I am. I have to pray for the children that others refuse to, all of them victim to our delusions. And I will never confine my heart. It will run wild and borderless and never join the energy of war. I asked my ancestors what to do when it felt like people had so lost the way. Breathe, they said. Breathe, because at the end of the exhale is what we avoid but need, our grief, our vulnerability, our rage. Gravity can help you tell the truth that there was never a human life worth more than another, though many of us have soothed ourselves with that lie. The worst of what we do to each other is done in terror, in apathy, and despair. This is reason enough to feel and make sure that everyone has the room to feel and to be at home. All of us to be at home. Our safety is quilted like a tapestry. It is never erected like a wall. There's so much to say about that poem, but I want to build in particular on that last line. Our safety is quilted like a tapestry. It is never erected like a wall. The level of carnage and violence from both the October 7th terrorist attacks and the catastrophic civilian casualties in Gaza are only possible through a dehumanization of the other. And we desperately need reconnection and rehumanization. Our safety is quilted like a tapestry, never built like a wall. When I think of what that looks like, I'm reminded of the poetic story I shared with you a few weeks ago. How many of you are here when I read Gate A4 by the Palestinian poet Naomi Shihab Nye? Okay, some of you were. It's too long for me to read again in full. If you don't know it, Google it later, Gate A4. Some of you remember this beautiful and moving story about comforting a crying and confused Palestinian woman that ended with everyone at the airport gate sharing cookies and apple juice. In Nye's words, I'm going to read just the last few sentences. I looked around that gate of late and weary ones, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. Truth and compassion are the only way out. So what does a shared world look like for two people so long divided by violence and resentment and competition? You know, how do we go from this, how do we get to like something non-zero sum, that like my loss is your gain and vice versa? How do we begin to quilt safety like a tapestry between two sides who both believe they have the right to the whole cloth and keep hoping the other side will just go away? Here's one particularly blunt answer from Daniel Kurtzer. He's a professor at Princeton University's School of Public and International Affairs and a former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and to Israel. He said recently that if Palestinians expect reverting to 1948, that's the map on the left, the original UN partition plan of a much larger Gaza Strip and West Bank, if Palestinians expect reverting to 1948, they're going to be sorely disappointed. If Israelis believe they can achieve an agreement of long-term peace on something less than 1967, that's the smaller Gaza Strip and the West Bank and the map on the right that came after the Six-Day War or the Third Arab-Israeli War, they're going to be sorely disappointed. If we zoom in on the West Bank on the right, so it's confusing, right? The West Bank is in the east, but it's the West Bank of the Jordan River, right? That's why it's the West Bank. Come to Israel and Palestine, learn these things. if we zoom in on the West Bank in the east, here's the reality of the Palestinian West Bank today under occupation. It's divided into areas A, B, and C with different levels of Israeli and Palestinian control that looks like Swiss cheese. The green and brown splotches are the Palestinian cities and villages. The much larger gray areas are Israeli settlements, military areas, roads, state lands. The current state of affairs has prompted many analysts to say that this hypothetical two-state solution is actually no longer possible, and that we have a one-state reality that we need to come to terms with. If that's an accurate assessment, the best alternative I have heard to the two-state solution, if we can make that happen, great, whatever. But the best alternative I've heard, the sanest, most humane alternative, is actually a confederacy, a variation of a European Union model. The model for a confederation-based peace process is two states, one homeland. Both Israeli and Palestinian governments would be accountable for the safety and civil rights of its citizens, but the borders would be porous with again, security provisions. People would live where they wanted. My favorite part of this is all those Israeli settlers would end up under Palestinian governance, but in the West Bank. This option may be the only, again, sane and humane possible and for both sides to get what they want. Access to the whole land, right? This confederation, European Union style model, everyone gets access to the whole land. Again, it's the shared world. Our safety is quilted like a tapestry. It is not erected like a wall. Now, if this sounds like a pipe dream, it's important to underscore that even after the Nakba, approximately 150,000 Palestinians remained inside Israel's current borders. Today, there are approximately 1.6 million Palestinian citizens of Israel, comprising about 20% of Israel's total population. Millions of Palestinians are walking around Israel every day. There are ongoing issues of discrimination that need to be resolved, but it's just not true that Israelis and Palestinians can't live together. They have in the past, they do in the present in great numbers, they can in the future if both sides commit to getting at the root causes of the ongoing violence. We remain a long way from making any such dream a reality, but when I think about what it would take to plant seeds of a shared future, the image that keeps coming to mind is of a sign that we also saw in that Ada refugee camp near Bethlehem. It said, "Make hummus, not walls." As Elad, our Israeli tour guide, shared with us what he preached from this pulpit back in September, an enemy is someone whose story you haven't heard. We need a lot more people getting together over hummus, though also people fight about the right hummus recipe. But we need a massive scaling up of opportunities for Israelis and Palestinians to have regular opportunities to hear one another's stories, facilitated by some variation on a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Both sides need to break bread together, to hear one another's truths, and to allow their hearts to break in compassion for all the pain experienced by both sides, themselves and the other. One of the most powerful ways to do that would be for as many people as possible on both sides to learn both Arabic and Hebrew so that listening can happen in each person's native language. That could set the stage for both Arabic and Hebrew to be the official languages of a confederated Israel and Palestine. Our UU values call us to advocate for more justice, more interdependence, equity, generosity, pluralism, more than one way, transformation, and most centrally, love. And we saw firsthand on our trip that connections between Israelis and Palestinians, they happen all the time when they are given a chance. I'll give you one poignant example that's been on my heart. Some of you will recognize the name Mahmoud Darwish, who prior to his death in 2008 was known as Palestine's national poet. As a side note, please do read Darwish, but one of today's most well-known Palestinian poets is Masab Abu Toha. I recommend his powerful book published last year, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear. If you remember Edward Said, he runs the Edward Said Library in Gaza, or I think he did before it's now been destroyed. Some of you may have heard his terrifying story of recently being illegally detained by the Israeli military. Thankfully, he was able to escape through the Rafah Gate and is now in Egypt. Returning our attention to Darwish, I was fascinated to learn that the most famous poet of the Palestinian resistance dated a Jewish woman for 2 years. When we give humans a chance to meet, they make connections. They can even fall in love. Our safety is quilted like a tapestry. I invite you to hear just one of Darwish's poems about the travails of his star-crossed romance with his Jewish lover amidst an Israeli military occupation. Between Rita and my eyes, there is a rifle. And whoever knows Rita kneels and prays to the divinity of those honey-colored eyes. And I kissed Rita when she was young, and I remember how she approached and how my arms covered the loveliest of braids, and I remember Rita the way a sparrow remembers its stream. Rita, between us there are a million sparrows and images and many a rendezvous fired at by a rifle. Rita's name was a feast in my mouth. Rita's body was a wedding in my blood, and I was lost in Rita for 2 years. And for 2 years, she slept on my arm, and we made promises over the most beautiful of cups. And we burned in the wine of our lips, and we were born again. Ah, Rita, what before this rifle could have turned my eyes from you, except a nap or two or honey-colored clouds? Once upon a time, oh, the silence of dusk, in the morning, my moon migrated to a far place, toward those honey-colored eyes, and the city swept away all the singers and Rita. Between Rita and my eyes, a rifle. Right now, the incentives on both sides continue to be deeply perverse, further locking in this vicious cycle. It will take ongoing pressure from the international community, very much including the United States, if there is to be a possibility of incentivizing both sides to co-create a future in which Jewish lives matter and Palestinian lives matter. In that spirit, I will end by inviting you to hear once more that poem by Prentice Hemphill. Love has told me lately. Love has told me lately that I have to let my heart break without seeking its repair too soon, that I have to speak before the words have formed fully in my mouth. I have to risk being misunderstood to show you who I am. I have to pray for the children that others refuse to, all of them victim to our delusions. I will never confine my heart. It will run wild and borderless, never joining the energy of war. I asked my ancestors what to do when it felt like people had so lost the way. Breathe, they said. And at the end of the exhale is what we avoid but need, our grief, our vulnerability, our rage. Gravity can help you tell the truth that there was never a human life worth more than another, though many have soothed themselves with that lie. The worst of what we do to each other is done in terror, in apathy, and despair. This is reason enough to feel and to make sure everyone has the room to feel and to be at home. Our safety is quilted like a tapestry. It is never built like a wall. Holding all of this in our heart, I invite you to rise in body or spirit and sing a song that reminds us of what the peace we're seeking to build. Number 159, This Is My Song.